Hi, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, June 27th, 1996. In the fireside room this morning, our speaker is Jeffrey Staley, continuing his series, A Spirit-Born Community, Jesus, the Disciples, and Us, in Luke Acts. Today is session number 4 and is titled, Hometown Boy Acts Up, Luke 4:14-44, and Acts 6:1-7:8, and 51:8:1. Let's listen in.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Jeff Staley, and we are doing Bible studies in Luke Acts. This is the fourth, really, in a series of 10, although two separate weeks, and I have entitled these sessions A Spirit-Born Community, Jesus, the Disciples, and Us in Luke Acts, and the title of today's session is Hometown Boy Acts Up, and we're looking at Luke 4:14. I put up there 44. We won't get that far. I'm really focusing on the sermon itself in Luke 4:14 to verse 30. And I again have put a text up in the book of Acts to help guide your thinking or reading later on. We may make some comments about this text. It's Acts 6:1-7:8, and then of course is a long sermon and verse 51:8:1, and this gives you perhaps a text that is closest to Jesus' sermon in Nazareth is this, the speech of Stephen before the Sanhedrin in Acts chapter 7. Many similarities. Stephen is more long-winded than Jesus, but the result is virtually the same in both cases. And it gives you some idea of this, then, Jesus, the disciples, and us, essentially what Jesus does, his followers or future followers of the followers will be doing too. Whenever I read this story in Luke chapter 4, it reminds me of a high school reunion. I've yet to attend a high school reunion. I haven't even seen a brochure or a letter from my high school saying that they're having one. And now, let's see, I've passed my, getting close to the 30th. It's pretty hard to believe. Coming up on the 30th high school graduation, or anniversary of the high school graduation. I don't know, there was nothing at the 25th, so I suspect I'll see nothing for the 30th. But anyway, I kind of have to imagine what these might be like, and one that I think of is an imaginary one. Supposing you went to Modesto High School in the early 1970s, and you had this person in your class, Stephen, who, you know, was kind of floating in and out. No one really knew the person well, and he was kind of a geek. Stayed by himself, and his mind was floating off in the clouds somewhere, interested in science fiction and strange things. And anyway, but you see his name in the papers about 10 years later, and find out that he's becoming quite wealthy making movies. Lo and behold, you get a note for your 25th high school reunion asking you to attend, and there's an added note in there that even Steven is going to be there. And of course, this is Steven Spielberg, who has made quite a name for himself with films. And is going to be doing a, you know, kind of a reflections on his years at Modesto High and events afterwards. And so this is really exciting, you know. As you get ready to go to the high school reunion, you kind of think of, wow, you know, any memories you might have of this guy when he was in high school, anecdotes, little stories. And for the life of you, you can't come up with any. You know, you look back at your yearbook, and yeah, you know, I think he was in the chemistry class, but you know, you really can't think much about him. And so, but you're all excited. Everybody's excited to hear what he's going to have to say. I won't tell you what he's going to have to say, but we suppose he did something like Jesus did at Nazareth and kind of blows everybody out of the water. Instead of talking about how wonderful it is to be back and his fond memories of the place, all he can remember is the people who rejected him in high school. And you come away with a much different feeling than you went there with. You know, why? Who does he think he is anyway? You know, okay, maybe he has a few million bucks, but you know, why are these memories of his high school rejection still so strong? Who knows what that kind of reunion might be like? And maybe you've been to high school reunions where somebody has made quite a name for themselves, and it's been an interesting event in that circumstance. But from my high school, I was voted most likely to succeed, so that tells you, that tells you what they were working with. Didn't have much. But anyway, it would be fun to go back and see what some of my friends have been doing. But this story is kind of like that. Jesus is returns to his hometown after a short tour of Galilee. And what I want to do this morning is to give you some time to read through this, Luke chapter 4, verse 14 through verse 30. And in light of some of the things we've been talking about in previous mornings about how Luke sets up the story, sets up the gospel, we talked on Monday and a little bit on Tuesday about how the story has the proper beginning. Of any of the Gospels, Luke sets it up in kind of the most appropriate setting, with the temple in Jerusalem, a priestly family. Everything is right, the time, the place, the people. The only problem was, of course, this couple had no child. Unlike the story in Mark, which begins with John's baptism in the wilderness. So also, when we begin then the public ministry of Jesus, which is here in chapter 4, everything seems to have the proper beginning. And what I would like you to think about as you read through, what are some of those elements? What is proper about beginning Jesus' public ministry in the way that Luke does? And that is these particular, this opening scene. Matthew and Mark, when they begin the public ministry of Jesus, do it somewhat similarly. That is, Matthew is the most similar. When Matthew begins the public ministry of Jesus, it's with a sermon also, but there it's the Sermon on the Mount. What's unusual about that, and perhaps we should say not quite proper, is the fact that it's out in the open. It's not a normal place for people to preach, but Jesus does that. In Mark's gospel, there's the call of the disciples, and then Jesus is in a synagogue in Capernaum on a Sabbath when he's speaking and this demon-possessed person interrupts him. And so there is a degree. So each gospel, interestingly, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the synoptics, quite close to the beginning of Jesus' public ministry or as his first public act, have Jesus giving a sermon. But they're quite different. This particular one is only found in Luke. It is this opening sermon in Luke's gospel is not found in Mark, and it's not found in Luke, and it's not found in John. So because of that, you can find a lot of what you might call Lucan themes in this opening sermon, so much so that many people have looked upon it as kind of programmatic. Gives you a clue as to the whole rest of Jesus' life. You could take a concordance, for example, which biblical scholars love to do, and look up a lot of the words that Jesus is using in here, the expressions, and see that they are used again and again throughout the Gospel of Luke and even into the book of Acts. So it's really a programmatic sermon or proclamation that sets the tone really for the rest of his ministry. And that's part of what we want to look at today. What is in here that reflects what Luke's understanding of the Spirit is and how the Spirit works or doesn't work in a particular community. So anyway, but that's a bit further on. What I want to do now is to give you a few minutes to read Luke 14 or 4:14 through 30. Think about these two questions. Actually, I have one. What is proper about beginning Jesus' public ministry in the way that Luke does? And then secondly, which is really a tough question that's caused a lot of commentators to write extensively about it. What responses does Jesus' reading engender and why? There's the real focus of this sermon is the responses, and the question for a lot of scholars is why in the world does it evoke the responses that it does, the reading actually, and Jesus' first remarks. So think about that as you read, and then we will have some time to reflect on this and go on from there. So you may stop the tape now, and we will begin reading. So, question. What is proper about this beginning? Where, in terms of setting, in terms of characters, action, that makes it appropriate for an opening to a public life?
Starting from home seems to be appropriate.
Okay, he starts from his home place, even though that short little summary says he's been other places, but the real opening right is here. What better place than, you know, when you're beginning your presidential candidacy to go to your hometown and kind of evoke the images of hard work and rural America that are still have mythic importance to America. So right, so Jesus goes to his hometown, that's significant, I think.
In the synagogue.
Okay, not only his home, and actually some translations, the New RSV does say hometown. Technically in Greek it's his home territory. So he's in his home territory, he's in his home city. Again, technically Luke calls Nazareth a city, and then narrowing it down even more, he's in the most appropriate place to be in that for a person of who's going to be an important religious figure, a prophetic figure. He's in the synagogue. Now, normally people aren't in the synagogue every day, but he's in this. So another part of the setting is not only is he in the synagogue, but it is on the Sabbath, so he's got the right time, the right place, three places, home, city, territory.
He's liturgically correct. He stands up to read. He sits down to speak. So he's starting out on the right foot in this.
Yeah. That's right. He's starting out on the right on the right foot. He finds the places. This is interesting. Some people in the earlier Bible study asked the question of, you know, did he choose the reading or was the reading already set? And we don't really know much about the liturgical reading in the first century. There's been a lot written about it. Some argue that the readings were lectionary readings were set at the time of Jesus. Others say no, they weren't, and we'll use this to argue that since he finds the place, maybe they weren't. You know, anyway, there's arguments both ways as to the synagogue service, and the problem is we don't have any sources from the first century; they're all significantly later. But anyway, and then of course, what about in terms of actions? Not only does he stands to read like a herald, and sits to teach like a rabbi. What else? He reads, so he's doing the appropriate kinds of things. Now, there's been fairly recently a fair amount of stuff written about Jesus in reading. If you're familiar with the spate of books out about Jesus particularly those related to the Jesus Seminar. Dominic Crossan has a book out. Jesus, a Revolutionary, what is it, biography or something like that? I forget. Which is a short version of a bigger book. Anyway, he argues in that, in his books, that he doesn't think Jesus was able to read. And Jesus is a peasant. What people know about peasant culture is Jesus could not have been able to read. So he would take this as Luke's construction. Whatever the answer is to that question, we do know that typically that reading and writing were activities of the elite. Whether Jesus as a prophetic type of figure would have learned to read somewhere along the way, or because of his being a Jew, if there was any kind of religious training, perhaps you could read. We don't know, but at least if you were a reader outside of Palestine in the first century, the fact that Jesus himself could read is a signal of reasonably high status, I think, would have been for the Greco-Roman world outside of Palestine anyway. So this, again, I think would be one of those markers that would set Luke's view of Jesus apart from some of the others. That is, in Matthew, there is no evidence, I don't think nowhere does Jesus read in Matthew, nowhere in Mark's gospel does Jesus read, nowhere in John's gospel does Jesus read, although there is a story about him writing with the woman caught in adultery, which is a story that doesn't belong in John, but has been put in there and textually, so that we don't have very many stories of Jesus reading. This is the most dramatic.
Jews could read long before anybody else, even down through the Middle Ages. Jews could read because they were so tied to their scrolls. So I don't think it's funny that a Jew,
learned
to read more than anybody else.
That's the question. Part of it for. Part of it has to do with, how expensive are scrolls, how well were they, how easily available, and then, right, to what extent, Judaism is a, certain segments of it, certainly a religion of the book, and that's the big question, is to what extent Jews might be able to read at a higher percentage.
Especially
than
the boys that went to the synagogue often, which he did.
This is according to Luke, he does. But again, if you're a peasant, this is, it depends on where you put Jesus in the social status of his day. But this is it's a big topic, and Crossan is one that says this is not.
There's a story in one of the Gospels when he was 12 years old.
That's right. Good question. Where does that come from? Anyone know? What gospel?
Luke.
That's Luke also. Yeah. So this again would play in with the higher status of Jesus according to the gospel of Luke. The other interesting thing is in here when it says, isn't this Joseph's son? The other gospels talk about Jesus as Joseph's son, but the son of Joseph the carpenter, or Jesus the carpenter, which again is an interesting thing that Luke never says. Luke is a gospel that never says Jesus is a carpenter or the son of a carpenter, although that's in Mark also and in Matthew. And a carpenter, that is a woodcutter basically, is a very low status person in the scale. So there are some interesting clues anyway that the beginning of this, Jesus seems to have a fairly high status. If we're thinking of outside of Judaism, this would be the kind of thing, say, this guy's kind of up there. He's not a person that is low down on the status, unlike Mark, for example, when Mark's Jesus is definitely lower status. But so he can't, he in this gospel he reads and he picks a text, or a text is given to him, which is from Scripture, and a text from Isaiah, a prophet. And this is going to be important because Jesus associates quite closely with the prophets in this gospel. Another thing with this spate of Jesus books, for instance, Crossan's book wants to call Jesus a cynic peasant. Now, there may be some similarities to Jesus and the Greco-Roman cynics, but from my perspective, you know, the category that fits nicely and best is the category, actually, that we have here in Luke, a category that comes straight out of Hebrew tradition, and Jesus as a prophet. Why, you know, prophets can be as cynical, satirical, parodying religious practices, whatever, like a cynic might do, and you have it all there right in Judaism anyway. Why do you have to go outside to Greco-Roman culture to get a model for who Jesus was? Jesus uses then a quote, our quote scripture, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." Jesus as a prophetic figure anointed by the Spirit, who is announcing, as many have pointed out, a jubilee type year, a year of release of debts and release from slavery. This is a remarkable kind of place to begin your ministry with this kind of quote. And another important element here is to recognize that when Jesus is talking about compassion in these texts and freeing the oppressed, he's quoting his own tradition. As you know, so often within Christian circles, you get, well, Jesus stands for compassion against Jewish legalism. It's extremely important to recognize that where Jesus begins his ministry is not with something new. Okay, this is not, he's not saying here, I'm starting something new, you know, now God is about compassion and forgiveness. No, he's quoting his own ancient scriptures and traditions that these people would be familiar with. That is, their God is a God of compassion, and Jesus is now saying, what? Today this is fulfilled in your hearing. It's not something new. It's something that has been there and is now in some unusual way being encapsulated, I guess he might say, in this anointing this of the Spirit upon him. But it's not something that is that is radically different from a tradition out within Judaism. So anyway, that's, I think, an important thing to say. And then he rolls up the scroll, gives it back to the attendant, sits down. Everyone's eye is fixed on him. And he began to say to them, "Today the scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing." And all spoke well of him and were amazed at the gracious words that came from his mouth. Now, the next question is, what responses did Jesus' reading engender and why? This is the tough question here, I think. What do people do with this? I mean, this is a pretty nice beginning. What happens, though?
Well, the first reaction was, they said, isn't it nice?
Yeah, okay. That sounds good. I mean, things are starting out right for this man who's beginning his public ministry, and I'm from this gospel, his first sermon, everyone is quite impressed, shaking his hand, I suppose, and saying, you know, your seminary training has done you well, and we spent our money well. Yeah.
What follows seems to be saying, Jesus seems to be saying, you folks don't get it.
Okay.
By what follows?
Right, by what follows, it seems to be saying that you folks don't get it. That's right. What you were going to say?
Well, when you take the two parts together, it sounds like they're excited that he's saying that he's fulfilling this in a way he'd be saying maybe he's the Messiah. And so they're thrilled that he's coming from them. But then when he kind of disowns his hometown,
uh-huh.
and kind of says, I'm not going to do any of my work here.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they're not so thrilled about him being someone fulfilling that message if he's not going to reflect well on them.
Okay, okay. Now, why would Jesus... Yeah, what is it that is there some change in here that we simply, there's a gap in the story that we don't know where he, there's this change that he says, I'm not going to do this. I mean, after this great beginning, why would he change his attitude, so to speak, to say, I'm not going to, you're looking for these things, but they're not going to happen here. Is there any clue in there, do you think, that things might have changed? I mean, they start out great, like you said. Everyone's amazed at his words. That's what the narrator says. What do they themselves say? The narrator says everyone spoke well of him and were amazed at the gracious words that came from his mouth. They said what?
Do the miracles here that we hear you've been doing other places.
Oh, wait, that's not... Okay, the first thing...
Joseph's son.
Right, it's not this Joseph's son, their first remark. And then he says, and then Jesus responds. Right, now this sounds pretty good to us. I mean, if you think of kind of, again, the American myth of the president who, you know, anybody can be president. A person growing up in a log cabin can sit in the White House. The story of the classic immigrant family who comes with only a penny in their pocket and within a generation have built themselves quite an economic, good economic base of, you know, conquered the world, you know, in some way. They have made a name for themselves. They have established themselves economically. This is the world, the nation of opportunity, you know. Start out with nothing and you can become somebody. But this is not the ancient Mediterranean mode of thinking. And all you have to do is go back to the beginning of this gospel, how carefully Luke sets up the birth narratives, show you in a way that a person who is going to be an important figure has to have an important beginning, an important birth. This is crucial for the ancient Mediterranean world. Important people come from important cities, come from important families. So this is one reason, I think, again, why in Luke's gospel, Nazareth is a city. Why? Because nobody, as John says, what's Nazareth? You know, nobody important comes from a town like that. It's just out in the middle of nowhere. You can't have important people coming from unimportant places. You can't have important people coming from unimportant families or without unimportant births. So in this gospel, you have a remarkable birth, which then is a portent of the kind of person Jesus is going to be. So when these characters here say, isn't this Joseph's son? It's not said in the sense of, wow, you know, local boy makes good, Steven Spielberg. You know, he was nobody. But isn't this remarkable? What a testimony to American ingenuity and, you know, the American capitalistic system. You can start out as dumb as he was and have a stupid idea and get people to buy into it, you know, and make movies and things like that and become really wealthy and famous. No, in this particular worldview, if you have an inauspicious beginning, there can only be one result, an inauspicious life and an inauspicious ending. So when they say, isn't this Joseph's son? It's like, you know, this Joseph is a nobody here in town. Who is he trying to tell us he is? You know, this is the kind of, his birth doesn't tell us. So there's the only other way you can claim to status, if it ain't by birth, it's going to be then some kind of powerful deed of something, you know, that Jesus certainly hasn't proved from his hometown family that he's got the birth to back up anything that he's saying about himself. Okay, he doesn't have the birth status to back up what he's saying about himself as a spirit. So the only other option he has to prove his status is going to be, guess what? Some kind of powerful deed or something like this. And so I think when these people say, isn't this Joseph's son? It's not like, wow, isn't this, you know, local boy makes good. No, he's a nobody. So when Jesus, I think, gets at that when he says, doubtless you will quote to me, we almost say then. Since you have said, I'm only Joseph's son, then doubtless you will quote to me this proverb, doctor, cure yourself. And he will say, do here in your hometown the things you have heard in Capernaum. So, you know, he catches their sense that the only other option he's going to have to prove to them who he is some miraculous deed. The other option, I think, too, is that if he is really somebody, then he ought to bestow some benefaction on his hometown, too. I mean, Steven Spielberg coming back to Modesto, he ought to donate money for a new library, you know, the Steven Spielberg Memorial Library, whatever. Jesus coming back after having a reputation, if this reputation and status is real, he ought to then bestow some element of benefaction on his hometown crowd, and which is another thing they're looking for, you know, which then he comes back. Were you going to say something up there? Oh, yeah, you have to wash those hands up and look like no, that's fine. So I think this is kind of the underlying issue in here, why Jesus then responds the way he does. No, a prophet has honor everywhere, to put it in a positive way. Prophets have honor everywhere except in their hometown. And part of the reason is because you know who they, you know, I know who that kid was. You know, I used to play ball with him, and he used to cheat when he played. You know, now look, thinks he's a really honest fellow. You know, these things don't work when you know all the dirty laundry on the family. So no prophet is accepted in a prophet's hometown. But the truth is, and then he has a couple of illustrations here that come from where? Jesus kind of,
History
again, right. Instead of saying that he's somebody totally new and different, he shows some interesting comparison to ancient, again, Jewish history. And he picks out what kind of characters, interestingly enough? Two prophets, right. Two prophets, Elijah and Elisha, who were particularly known for what kinds of stuff? What do you know about Elijah or Elisha?
Go back to you.
Miracles, right. Yeah, they were, right, acts of power. And that is, of course, going to be typical of Jesus' own life as well. That is, Jesus is a miracle worker. These are evidences of God's Spirit, mighty acts of power, like in Elijah and Elisha. Interestingly enough, in this gospel, Jesus will raise a widow's son from the dead. Jesus will have contact with a foreign military officer, a centurion. He heals a centurion's slave boy, like Naaman the Syrian, or like the widow's son that Elisha raises. So, you know, there are interesting comparisons in this gospel. The interest, and beyond that, what Jesus does, if you get to the book of Acts, guess what? The disciples do the same thing. The disciples can raise, the apostles raise people from the dead. Peter, of course, has an interesting confrontation with a military officer, a centurion. You go on further, and so does Paul. So, what if you look at the Spirit, what's the point? The same Spirit that was in Elijah and Elisha is now active in Jesus, is now, and then later, guess what? We'll also be active. The same Spirit that was in Jesus is going to be in the Christian community performing the same kind of deeds. An important element of Luke's understanding of the Spirit is the same Spirit that was in Elijah, Elisha is in Jesus, is in the apostles, and then, of course, the interesting question in what we'll explore a couple weeks, when, of course, none of you will be here, but if portent, you have to come back in 2 weeks, will be how this then gets, how Luke argues that this gets carried on in the contemporary, quote, contemporary church. I think he's got an interesting argument for that. Anyway, so there's a clear argument in here, I think, that Luke is saying Jesus is like one of these prophets. He claims to be to have an anointing of the Spirit like Elijah, like Elisha, and in the spirit of the prophet Isaiah.
Well, and it seems the choice of Elijah, since Elijah seemed to be a really big one to these folks, they were, you know, the last, the end of what we have as the Old Testament, is it's Elijah that they were waiting for.
Okay.
Elijah's the one that gets talked about when he's dying on the cross, so Elijah must have been really big to these
people. Yeah, yeah.
So that seems like a particularly strong choice.
Yeah, and not only the emphasis on the Spirit and the miracles, but the one who is coming. The interesting thing, again, in Luke's gospel is, although at the beginning John will have the spirit of Elijah, it's really Jesus that's more like Elijah. In this gospel, the baptism story we looked at yesterday, Luke does not tell you what John looked like, that he, you know, was wearing the camel skin loincloth, whatever, which is what the hairy mantle that Elijah had and Mark has John wearing is not in the Gospel of Luke. So in a sense, Jesus is Elijah more than John being Elijah. And of course, Elijah also has an unusual death, right? Swing low, sweet chariot. So there's peculiar things going on with the death of Elijah, which of course then are appropriate to the death of Jesus. There's also there are two men clothed in white on the mountain, which most, you know, associate with Elijah and perhaps Moses. And then they also appear at the tomb. They're not angels in Luke's gospel that appear at the tomb or at the ascension, but again, two men in white raiment, which again, for some people, tie this in with one of them anyway, perhaps being an Elijah figure, Moses and Elijah. Now, that's a bit more tenuous to argue that, but there is at least clear emphasis in Luke Acts on Jesus as Elijah rather than John the Baptist as Elijah. He's the prophet, the spirit-filled prophet. Now, the interesting thing, you have a question, comment?
No, go on.
What I was going to turn to is the kinds of stories that Jesus picks out about Elijah and Elisha. I mean, they're both miracle stories, but that's not so important in this as something else. What is Jesus getting at in these stories that really gets these people, his hometown audience, upset?
The miracles are done for non-Israelites.
Okay, the miracles are done for for non-Israelites, people outside of Israel. Now, which then the interesting question for me is here, why is that? What if you want to think about the work of the Spirit? You know, the emphasis in both of them is only one. Many, many, but only one. But only one. And to think about that in terms of the work of the Spirit. But think about that for a minute. And your question is?
I was going to say that it seems to me that the response of these people initially is disbelief. And then finally it's rage.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Instead of, like when he reads this, instead of this Joseph's son, local boy made good, but in fact it's disbelief. Because when he reads this, that the Spirit of the Lord is upon me, and he sits down, and the eyes are fixed on him, as though, why would he have the audacity to read this to us?
Uh-huh.
And then he gets up and says, well, this day
the scriptures are being fulfilled. Mm-hmm. And so this amazement is not simply surprise.
No, no.
But really disbelief.
Right, but yeah, initially, yeah, I think you're right. That if you were to stop reading simply with the wondering, it sounds positive, but you're right. As you even read the next words and sentence, it's, there is this sense of disbelief at this person's audacity to come in. In the earlier Bible study, someone had said it's like, you know, somebody coming, standing up to read the lectionary reading and then launching into the sermon, you know. Well, wait, here's a pastor, right? That's their job. You know, who gives you the right? You're just supposed to be there doing the reading, you know. And here he launches into this. It's like, hey, wait a minute, you know. Who authorized you? Who do you think you are doing that? You know, and then to say the kinds of things you're saying. That's out of character.
But it almost seems like Jesus perceives that they expect some special favor.
Yeah, yeah, I think you're right.
And
right.
So that paragraph I gathered, he's saying, why should you think you're going to have special favor?
Okay.
But it puzzles me a bit. He almost provokes them by saying,
okay.
And why does he have to do that?
Okay. Yeah, this is, again, I think part of, some have argued anyway, part of the Mediterranean culture that is a challenge and riposte culture where it's a one-upmanship kind of thing. You know, it's really not a dialogue, but here's the challenge, and then you respond with another challenge, and you respond. And these are, you know, Jesus's honor is at stake, and in a sense, you know, he's got to make good on his claim of honor, and if his claim of honor and respect is right, then he ought to, by the nature of that, in this community, bestow that honor, some of that, you know, let it flow out onto his hometown. That's just the natural way things work. I mean, this is, you know, it's the way Chicago worked. I mean, used to work, right? You know, the patronage system. This is the way the ancient Mediterranean world worked. That is, if you're a famous person, yeah, it's. I live in Portland, so you know, it's the Hatfield. I mean, all the things that that he's done for the city of Portland and building the, you know, the hospitals and things like this. I mean, it's, when we lose Packwood and Hatfield, we lose, you know, enormous amount of clout that has gone to the Pacific Northwest. That's the way the patronage in our upper echelons of our government work too. And that was here then. He's a person who has made a claim to high status. His family doesn't give it to him, that's for sure. Of course, there's an irony there because we know a story that they don't know, right? We know the story about the virginal conception. So in fact, Joseph isn't the father, but in some unique way, God is. So he does have a claim. They don't know it. He's got to show them some miraculous deed, and he ought to do it here because this is his hometown. He has to, you know, show some sign of benefaction for this city.
Of course, there are a lot of conversations going on that we don't have written down here, so he would no doubt have been walking around. I think sometimes we forget that these, you know, were real people walking around with real villagers. He's heard conversations. He's probably heard people talking that, ooh, now Jesus is here. Did you hear what happened in Capernaum? Ooh, now we're going to see it.
So right, right.
I think that's also a very logical interpretation of that he's heard them talk about it. Plus, we have a lot of other stories that Jesus can read people's hearts. So he knows stuff that they're thinking, too. But I think just hearing the conversations would make sense. He knows they've come in there, okay, here we go.
Well, yeah, yes. Yeah, and that's actually the way the text begins. He's going, a report of him has spread throughout all the surrounding country that his deeds. So if he's done things there, then he ought to do even greater things here. You know, that's the point. That's the way it ought to. You've shown benefaction in those cities, and that's pretty great, but we get even more, you know. It's not enough just for them to get it, and to us get as much, we will get more because you're the hometown guy.
Couldn't they wait a little bit? Unexpected? It seems to me they're very impatient.
Yeah.
For him to prove himself immediately.
Right. Well, this is a good point, because I think this shows kind of the what I would say, the programmatic knit. Part of, I think, Luke's intent is to heighten the drama and put it all right up, to have a rejection immediately, because this is then sets the tone for the whole rest of the book. That is, one of the marks, and this gets into tomorrow, one of the marks of a prophet, a true prophet, and the board should say P-R-O-F-I-T, not P-R-O-P-H-I-E-T. That is, what prophet, what P-R-O-F-I-T is a prophet. And because, for Luke's perspective, the only good prophet is a dead prophet. And so he wants to set this up right here. He intensifies, if you want to say he leaves a lot out, you know, what does he leave out? Whatever he leaves, he wants to intensify the emotional impact of this story so that there will be the rejection that sets the tone for the rest of the book. That is, what is the result of the prophet? If you look at the story of Elijah and Elisha, you know, Elijah has to run out into the desert, you know, and he's being, you know, they have interesting confrontations with Ahab and Jezebel. The mark of a true prophet is to be persecuted and killed. You know, that's, which again is, you talk about the spirit in a community. This is an interesting tension between the prophetic voice in a community and the other voices in a community that are trying to build some kind of, we might say, communal spirit. What is the connection between the prophetic voice and the other voices in the community that may be the conciliatory voices that that are trying to build connections? And the prophetic voice is the one that's always, you know, so often that's shattering and asking the tough questions that the rest of the community says, no, that's destructive, you know. Don't ask those kind of questions. They're going to destroy community. Well, Jesus in here, you know, he approaches this. I mean, where did Elijah and Elisha go? Are they the community-bound people here? I mean, they go outside the community. And then the fun question is, why do they go outside the community? He doesn't say explicitly, but there's lots of lepers, there's lots of widows, but they go to one leper and one widow outside of Israel. Why do you think they do that? From Luke's perspective, perhaps, anyway.
Because their own people rejected it.
Okay, yeah, I think that this is a hint. It doesn't say, Jesus is, you know, pretty good rhetorician here. He doesn't say explicitly. They catch the point, though, and the, you know, is that the people in power, whatever, in Israel have rejected this prophetic voice, and so the prophet goes outside. Now, I think that's true with both of those stories. That, you know, that is, we know, you read Elijah and Elisha's stories, the rejection, the persecution of Jezebel. I don't know if it's explicitly said in those stories, and Fred, you might have to help me here, that it says that the reason Elijah or Elisha goes to Naaman or to the widow is because of rejection. I think actually with the widow, he has gone there because of persecution, right? Now with Naaman, it isn't explicitly said that it's a result of.
Wasn't that the faith of the servant girl?
She knows, and right.
She heard about it.
Right. So there, it's not clear. It's not explicitly rejection, but here it seems to be that. So perhaps the spirit works. You know, if the spirit works in communities, when the community rejects the spirit, it goes outside. Is that part of the point? Yeah.
If you think of Luke and Acts as being together and getting to the point of an inclusive church,
yeah,
it certainly seems that the illustrations that are being used even here are at least lightning flashes to see how one how the church will be reaching out to those people
okay.
that perhaps the community needs to think seriously about, but have not yet, are not ready yet. And
okay.
Acts, of course, is the great struggle for
yeah.
for that kind of thing. So and it seems to me in all of Luke, there are heroes and heroines who are the unexpected mm-hmm. that Jesus is lifting up, or that
yeah.
Luke is lifting up for
yeah.
us to see.
Yeah.
So.
Right. It's interesting that the model of, I mean, one is a woman and one is a male outcast, and in this gospel, Jesus will have a lot of contact with women. Of course, he will have contact with a leper. And then there will be contact between the disciples or the apostles in the book of Acts and women. Women will play an important role there, and the healing ministry. And also, of course, the fact that these are non-Hebrews, non-Israelites, is a foreshadowing of the Spirit's work outside of the national boundaries, the ethnic makeup of the Jewish nation to Gentiles. And so there's that focus too. It is interesting. I mean, I don't know if you want to play much with the idea of the many and the one in terms of the Spirit's work. I mean, that's it. Get back to my story, if any of you were here a couple days ago, about how I was about to miss this plane. I knew I was going to miss the plane, but, you know, as a last resort, I prayed that, well, you know, it'd be nice, God, if the plane was delayed and to get to the airport. And sure enough, it was. And then I made the point of sometimes, I mean, for me, oftentimes, you know, quote, answers to prayer are more difficult than non-answers, you know, in the sense of, is there really a connection between that prayer and the plane being delayed? And what about all the people that screwed up their plans, you know? I mean, the fact that the plane was delayed, the person in front of me missed his connecting flights, you know, is trying to figure out where he could stay in a hotel and would the airline pay the difference and da-da-da-da. You know, I mean, there's all kind, you know, those kind of connections when you deal with, there are many, many sick people here, but only this person is healed. How do you relate that to the work of the Spirit? You know, there's many people here, but no, God calls me way overseas to that particular place. And, you know, how do you relate that to the work of the Spirit? How can you say that God is calling you way over there when there's so much need right here? Yeah.
This is slightly off, but you who our Bible scholars would know more. Do Bible scholars ever accept anything by faith? Or do they try to find something wrong with everything? Whether it be cross center, I mean, I've heard Martin Luther do it, and sometimes it seems like they explain everything divine away.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
I mean, do they accept some things by faith, or is it their job to try to take apart everything?
Well, part of it's, it is certainly part of our job to take these things apart and analyze them. I think for most of us, yeah, there is an element. Faith comes through through and around, in with and under, to use good Lutheran terms, I guess, a doubt, you know, that there is, and serious questions doesn't rule out the issues of faith. But I guess for me, my faith is lived out through, in many respects, the questions and where the questions lead me. But it can be disconcerting. I mean, to read, if you want to get off the subject, to some of to Crossan's book, for example, and you read some of these Jesus books and wonder, where is the person's faith in there? It is construed in a much different way. But it is there. When I teach using those books, part of the fun I have is to show where the faith is seen in that. But I mean, I'm not sure exactly how that relates to this question, other than, I mean, I think it is the work of the Spirit, since this is part of the theme of Holden, is a very tricky issue. In community, that is, Who speaks for the who? Where are the prophetic voice, and how do you know that it's a prophetic voice? I mean, you say, that person says that they're a prophet, okay. You know, you can feel, in a sense, the people of Nazareth is they're you know, a real tension here. Well, we know who you are. Now, you know, give some proof. And then the guy says he's not going to prove it. Well, then, okay, why should I believe? And if you're not going to work here where there's definite need, you know, like with Elijah and Elisha, we're not rejecting you. All we're asking is, you know, a good question, a serious question. And then you turn it upside down. And I mean, that's just the way prophets are. They think everyone's on their back. You know, they got this persecution complex. They take everything the wrong way. And then, of course, you know, we're not excluding you from the community. You've excluded yourself. You know, those are tough questions when you deal with a community. Those prophetic voices that are trying to lead one direction, and it might seem to split a community apart. If you take, for example, we're out of time, but I'll just say this. I mean, I'm a member of a Presbyterian congregation that this past year has decided to become a More Light congregation, which in the Presbyterian Church means a congregation that will, if a gay or lesbian name is put up on the slate for deacons or elders, will ordain deacons or elders that are gay or homosexual. And, you know, that becomes a really tough issue. Is it going to split the church? Is it, you know, is that kind of prophetic action? You might think this is the real guidance of the Spirit in this way. And others say, well, you know, it's going to split the church, or we're not going to get, you know, the capital needs are not going to, you know, we have all these needs. We're building a new building. People are going to leave. We won't have the money to do this. And what happens if we get called on the carpet? What are we going to do? You know, you have these tensions where certain elements of the Spirit in the community, say community building, and this other voice that says, but yeah, you know, we need a prophetic, this is the way the church ought to be going. And there's a real tension. How do you pull those two together, or don't you? And that's true in, you know, a lot of, any denomination, any community. And I think that's part of this issue in Luke and Acts, that it's an issue of faith. And I don't know if there are any real clear, easy answers. I think Luke gives one set of them, and that are an attempt to wrestle that out. But I don't know if that answers it, but for me it is, you know, it is rooted in real faith community decisions. And Luke is wrestling with that, I think, in the prophet. Let's just close with a word of prayer. God, as we go from this place, guide us in our conversations, in our behavior, in our actions, that we might continue to reflect on your word, on the work of the Spirit as a water-washed, Spirit-born community. Give us insight into how to work with each other, how to sense the Spirit, where to sense the Spirit, for it's in the power of that Spirit we pray. Amen.
Amen.